disciple was sent away for breaking the silence to exclaim about sunset. What's the difference between having a thought and expressing it verbally? Ah, that wasn't a thought. It was a seeing when there was no thoughts going on. Just like that. And there it was again. Just a few seconds ago, there was nothing going on in your mind. Again, there are so many moments of silence. That is listening, feeling, knowing, not thinking, but just knowing. That's the difference. If you understand that, you're halfway to nirvana. You've got to nib. You just need the bana afterwards. Dear Ajahn, is it just me, or is it really hot in the meditation hall in the afternoons? It's just you. You're weird. No, it is hot. It's been quite hot the last few days. There is an air conditioner over there if you want to put it on. But the trouble is, you put it on and it gets too cold and someone turns it off. And then someone else turns on again. You have this big argument exactly how much it should be. That's why I did suggest the next meditation center I build will have these little things which you can come down so you have your personal air conditioners. Then you won't have to worry about the person sitting next to you. So, if it's too hot in here for you, meditate in your rooms. It's nice and cool in there, especially in your toilets, or not on the toilets, but you know, in the bathroom, because it's got lots of tiles in there. That always keeps it very cool. And if you really are sort of very hot, then you can just take your clothes off and meditate under the shower. Now, cold water. Oh, it's just really, really nice. Just like the stream of bliss falling over your body. Whatever. So innovate. So you can always find a nice, quite cool place somewhere. This, you know, this time of the year, November, it's halfway between summer and the winter time, which we just finished. So sometimes it's hot, sometimes it's cool. You've had cool days, you've had warm days. So this is not a bad time to be at this retreat center, but there will be a few days which are hot. So if it's hot, remember Buddhist climate control. When it's hot, keep a cool head. When it's cold, keep a warm heart. If you do that, it doesn't matter what it's like outside. If it's hot, keep a cool head. If it's cold, keep a warm heart. And this is nothing. When I was a young monk, Ajahn Chah, the first year, after lunch, we only had one meal of the day, which wasn't very nice. And then afterwards, we go into this, we call that the old hall. It's actually just a very makeshift, four walls and a tin roof, really low. We had to put not just one robe, the spare robe on as well, and sit under the hot roof in the hottest part of the day for 2 hours. You could bring extra blankets if you wanted to. That was hot. And just after the meal, when you're hot, you're tired, you want to go to sleep, 2 hours. Now, if you can endure that, this isn't hot compared to that. So what happens sometimes when you really get hot? Well, this is nothing. And if you want to get cold, in Tibet, they had this old custom that you have to learn how to create your own inner heat. To endure being a hermit in the snow-ridden caves of the Himalaya mountains. And once you learn how to tolerate cold, they gave you a test. They take you out in the middle of the night in winter, where there was snow everywhere, and the winds were howling across the mountains. And they would sit you down by the edge of a lake. And take all your robes off. And you had to sit there in the icy cold wind. But you were allowed a blanket. the blanket will be dipped in the water of the lake first of all. And to pass the test, you'd have to dry 7 blankets throughout the night to show that, yes, you could tolerate the cold. And then you'd be allowed to go in the caves by yourself where it was freezing. So once I heard that, I thought, wow, that's cold. And anything I'd ever experienced since, that's not cold. That's just a bit chilly, that's all, but that's not cold. So a lot of the time it's in the mind. But it's, is it possible to please have the air conditioner on in the afternoon? If it's okay, maybe we could do a vote. Thanks. I think I may have heat stroke. Oh, come on. You won't get heat stroke. You might get air conditioning stroke. Okay, hands up. Who thinks we should have the air conditioner on in the afternoon? 1, 2, 3. Who thinks we shouldn't have it on in the afternoon? That's 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm sorry. The air conditioners have lost. Never mind. So you can get... What you can do is, again, go into the shower, this time with your clothes on. Because when it's nice and wet, then that cools you off. So you come here, drip, 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 sit down, all wet, and then that'll be natural air conditioning. Sorry, but that's the best we can do. What you can do, though, is see all the people who put their hands up. They didn't want air conditioning. Go up to them tonight, give them a bribe, see how much it costs to change their vote. That's called democracy. Well, it's democracy in Indonesia. And Thailand, sometimes. Very good. Next question. I'm enlightened. Enlightened as to the whereabouts of the Buddha in the bush. You found the secret Buddha garden. That means only people who have the karmic strength to discover the hidden Buddha can find this. So you have joined that elite club of people who know where the Buddha is. Dear Ajahn, why only vegetarian food be served during meditation retreat? Well, other times we could have non-vegetarian food. Thanks. And it was because I was badgered into it. And so we decided, we had a committee, just like the air conditioning. We had a little committee when we started this place. Should we have vegetarian food or any food? And the vegetarian ones won. So I lost. Never mind. So anyway, look, I'll tell you a trick. If any of you are carnivores, you like your meat or your sausages or you like your chicken or whatever. I can say this because Bianca's not here. Then at 10:30, you don't have to eat here. You can walk over to Bodhinyana and get your meal there. If you don't like the food over here, 10:30, you know, meal, you know that happens all the time. You just go there and you offer food into the monk's bowl. It's a nice thing to do, to participate in the alms round, offer food in the monk's bowl, and then you can go on to the buffet there. So what the nicest thing to do is ask Bianca, who's bringing the food today? And if it's not, you're like, I don't fancy that, so I'll go to Bodhinyana. Is that okay, bro? Should I tell them that? No, shouldn't tell them that. Of course you can do that. You do that. Dear emptiness, why aren't monks allowed to drive cars? Why we aren't? Because we are so mindful and so peaceful. We drive so slowly. We cause traffic jams. And we're so kind. When somebody wants to come, we would always let them in. We'd always let them in front of us. We'd always let them in. Which means we'd get stuck there for hours and hours and hours. We're so kind and compassionate. We're not aggressive enough, actually, to get in the right lane. You have to be really aggressive to drive cars. Especially in the city. If you're not aggressive or not, you don't get in. You can't turn the corner. You really have to push yourself. So that's why. Actually, some monks do drive cars, but in our tradition we don't. If there is no self, what or who is reincarnated and why? It is the delusion of a self which gets created, which gets reincarnated. You get reincarnated because you want to. And you say, I don't want to. If you don't want to, that's another type of wanting. You still get reincarnated. So let go of all the wanting and not wanting. And then you don't get reincarnated. So that's actually how to do this. And what do you actually get reincarnated is? It's what you incline towards in this life. That's what you get reincarnated as. If you talk too much on this retreat, you get reincarnated as a crow. Ga, 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 ga. If you sleep too much, you get reincarnated as a lizard, a horizontal being. Because you can never get vertical, you're always horizontal. So be careful how you spend your time. If you eat too much, you get reincarnated as a crocodile with a big mouth. Okay, that's what gets reincarnated and why. Dear Your Emptiness, your talk this morning is very profound. Thank you very much for conditioning us. Exactly. You know why you said that was very profound? Because I put that suggestion into your head. Everything you do here is conditioned. I brainwashed you. So much so, at the end of this retreat, you're going to make big donations. You're going to make big donations. You're going to make big... Now please forget that, but when it comes time... You know that story of there was a monk, he just started a new temple. And it was very hard to get enough funds to pay the bills. So he went to another monk he knew and said, look, I'm just really having a hard time getting donations. What should I do? He said, it's very easy. This is what I did. He said, when I gave the talk, I closed all the windows, made the hall really stuffy, turned up the heater, made it hot. And I gave a very boring sermon in a monotone. It was so boring that soon people started to fall asleep because there was nothing much. And once they started to get sleepy, he said, that's when I got out my watch and I moved it backwards and forwards until everybody in the hall was hypnotized. And then, once they were hypnotized and in my power, he said, I told them, when you go out the door, no coins. This is in Australia. No fives, no tens, no fifties. Well, okay, fifties are okay. Only fifties and $100 notes in the donation box. And then he took them out of hypnosis. He said, it worked. He got lots of money. And this young, I can't do that. Of course you can do that. It's good karma. You're helping people make good karma. So he gave it a try. The next time, he closed all the windows, turned up the heater, gave a very boring sermon, which was very easy for him. And when everyone's falling asleep, got his watch out, backwards and forwards, hypnotized everyone. Everyone must make a donation. No coins, no fives, no tens, no twenties, only fifties and hundreds. And when he came out of hypnosis, when they left, the donation box was full of $50 and $100 notes. He made a killing. But he thought, I won't do that every week. Soon people will find out. So he waited for a few weeks. And then when he needed some money again, he turned up the heater, closed the windows, gave a boring sermon, got his watch out, and they were just about to be hypnotized when he dropped his watch. He said, oh shit. And it took them a couple of weeks to clean up the mess. Did you get it? He said, oh shit. And that's what they did, because under hypnosis. Okay, never mind. I do really try. So that's why we don't do that anymore. We never did in the first place. Okay, so for daily practice, us lay people, how to live simple, not busy with duties. Well, we have to work and be busy 5 days a week. Why do you have to work 5 days a week? To pay all of your bills. So why not have less bills? Live in a smaller house, small apartment, share with other people. You can only be in one room at a time. So you can have, you know, like a timeshare. You know, one bedroom and one kitchen, so one person works at nights. So they're out and you're sort of sleeping in the bedroom at night time. The other person works during the daytime, so you can actually share a house because that's the best efficient use of the bedroom. And you know, same as the toilet. Because you have all these rooms. How often do you use your bedroom in your house? only 8 hours a night. The rest of the night, the rest of the day, it's lying idle. No one's using it. So if you can actually, you know, time share with your bedroom, same with your kitchen, so that, you know, one person is using it when you're finished, someone else can use it. Then you have 6 or 7 people in your house, and then you can actually obviously save a lot of money, share the rent, and have small things. And the same with clothes. You know, the one who's going out at night, sort of working at night, they can use the clothes, because you just have your bed clothes, and then when they come home and you're going out to work, you swap. If you're really old, you know, you can share your false teeth. Because you only need it when you're eating, and you don't have to eat at the same time. So, you know, it's my turn to eat now, so you can eat, and then when you're finished, give it to your friend today. That's why sometimes you tell, if you've got a beautiful wife or a beautiful husband, you can tell your wife, said, "Darling, you've got teeth like the stars." "Oh, really? That's such a nice thing to say." "Yes, they come out at night." We'll get off. Oh, no. So that way, if you live, no, seriously, if you live simply, you find you don't need to work so hard. You don't need to live in a big house. If you want a garden, go to the local park. They look after the garden for you, and you can sit out there. You don't have to mow the lawn or plant the flowers. You've got a park there. If you want a swimming pool in the back of your house, just get a house next to the beach or next to the local swimming pool. You've got a swimming pool next door. You don't have to maintain it. Other people maintain it for you. Even better, like what many people are doing these days in the city. They have a house, they don't have a kitchen in the house. Instead, they just go downstairs, and there's so many beautiful restaurants. They can have breakfast, lunch and dinner, whatever they want, and they never have to wash up. Imagine that. And when actually you, this is serious, when you compare the cost of a kitchen in a house, it's an enormous cost. Instead of having that cost of the kitchen, you can eat out every day. And you're usually, financially, you're still ahead. So all you need is a little box. That's all you need. You know, a box is about 6 foot long, 2 foot wide, and just, actually, just like a coffin. It's very comfortable. Close the lid, and it's nice and quiet. And, you know, you don't need much space for that. And you just go. And if you have, like, this little condominium, like a coffin condominium, and I've seen this in New York and many other places in Japan. You know when you park your cars? You actually park the cars and it goes up in a lift and it gets actually up to third level or something and automatically gets parked in the nearest spot. And when you want it back again, it comes off. It's really amazing. Have you seen those car parks? So you just go to one place and then it goes on the conveyor belts to where is the nearest place to park. When you want it, it comes back again for you. So you can have that with your coffin, you know, just in a big condominium. But only, it's only small like a house. You go in your little coffin to go to sleep at night, and then it sort of goes up, and wherever it gets parked, nice and quiet, and when you wake up, you press the button, you come back down again. And then you can actually go to the restaurant to get your lunch. If you want to go and hang out in the park, you can go out in the park. And if you want to sort of go out to a shower, you can, there's a night public showers there. It can be very cheap. You don't need a big house. That means you can probably work for a year and you pay for everything, and then you. And it's also the coffin is there for you when you die, so it's already there for you. And you get used to it. Because you're going to have to spend a lot of time in your coffin. You might as well test one out before you use it. But seriously, if we learn how to live simply, which is not that hard to do, we find we don't need so much money. Which means we don't have to work so hard. Please live simply. A Nimitta came up today and stayed for over 1 hour, which was awesome. Oh, other people can get jealous now. You should never say these things. Oh, I've been meditating for years and no Nimitta's ever come up for me. Can I borrow your Nimitta? Maybe if a Nimitta came up to this person, can you share it around? How does one know when it's time to open our eyes, or do we just keep going and letting go some more? Just keep on going. Enjoy it. If it's really the time, you just feel, oh, I've had enough now, and you come out. But go for broke. Keep on going. D- Dear Ajahn Brahm, thank you for a wonderful retreat and teachings. It hasn't ended yet. Talk about going off into the future. There's many days left yet. You haven't seen anything yet. It's wonderful so far. They say it's wonderful in the beginning, wonderful in the middle, and wonderful in the end, I hope. I enjoy walking meditations and have to ask, is it possible to have nimittas or jhana during walking meditation? I always thought no, but someone told me of a monk in Thailand who does get into jhanas when he was doing walking meditation. And the proof of that is all the bruises and cuts on his face. Because you don't know, you can't feel your body when you're doing walking. So you just actually carry on walking. And if you're actually walking outside, you may walk into the lake. It's okay, you won't drown, you just come out the other side. It's amazing what walking meditation can do. That'd be really cool. Especially if those people are complaining of the heat. Yeah, try that. Try doing walking meditation through the lake. No, don't do that, you'll drown or we'll get sued. While walking is good for relaxation, necessary for our limbs, I don't believe it functions as well as sitting for attaining the deeper meditations. Yeah, for most people, the sitting is the best posture for the deep meditations, or even lying down. What is the function of walking meditation? How would one be able to have deep meditation state while walking? Most people, they can't have deep meditation while walking, but still you can get reasonably deep. Now, the delightful walking, just walking, and it's so nice to be able to feel all the sensations in your feet. And then what that does means you get into quite a deep state of meditation, and then when you come and sit, it's very easy to get deep in sitting. So it's a support for the sitting meditation. That's why the Buddha said if you do lots of walking meditation, it's very easy to get into deep meditation. If you get quiet in the walking, and you come and sit down, it's very easy to go deeper. And that's also one of the reasons when we design this meditation center, at great expense because of our loving kindness for each one of you, we made these meditation walking rooms right next door for your convenience. You don't have to go very far to do walking meditation, just literally through that door. And when you want to sit down, you can come through again. And we were so kind to you that we gave you red carpets to do your walking meditation. That's how much we respect you. We give you red carpet treatments. Dear my super monk, that's nice. Whoever wrote this has got great discernment and great wisdom. Dear super monk, actually, you know that I mentioned that years and years ago, because apparently all these movies they have these days, they're always like these superheroes. These have started with Superman and Batman. And who else was Spider-Man? And who else is there? Who? I don't know who that is anyway, but some other superhero. So the one thing they haven't got is Supermonk, who flies through the air to save the lives of people in peril and difficulties. And who's got psychic powers so he can actually read the minds of the villains. So stop them doing the bad thing, even before they actually do it. It just stops them when they were thinking about it. And I had all this fantasy about Supermonk and getting Supermonk comics. And you know what? Somebody did one. This fellow over in Budapest, in Hungary, he heard me say this, and he was at the arts college in Budapest, and he, for his assignment, he did Supermonk comic. You know, based on my teachings. It's really funny. Have we still got a copy here, Dania? Supermonk. If you haven't seen it yet, it's really worthwhile looking at. Dear my Supermonk, because at the end, he gets this villain who's trying to destroy the world, and instead of actually criticizing the villain and saying what an evil person he is, you know, it's amazing, this death ray machine which will destroy the whole world. Your technological brilliance is amazing. You know, you're fantastic. He says, really? Because all evil people, no one's ever praised them. They only want to destroy the world because no one's ever loved them and appreciate them. So Superman comes along and actually praises them. Your death ray machine is a work of art. It's a technological marvel. Oh, really? Yeah, I mean, you should use your, your great skills for other things instead of causing death. Oh, I never realized that. That's a good idea. And just by praise, by positive reinforcement, by saying that your death ray machine is very good, it means that the villain becomes a good person. But then when the police come to arrest him, so Superman comes and said, oh, you should actually follow the Dharma. Let go. Let go. So they let the villain go. And that's the end of Superman. That's really, really neat. So it's up there somewhere. I think it's on the notice board, Dania.
It will be tomorrow.
Okay. Superman. Anyway, dear Superman, if right now and then my mother has a glass of wine every night to make her body healthy, since she has a weak health, does it mean she has broken the fifth precept? Well, you know, you've got to just do a middle way. So it's all right to have a little bit of alcohol. It's all right to have a little bit of adultery. A little bit of murder. A little bit of stealing. We always say a little bit for the fifth precept. What about a little bit of the third precept? A little bit of adultery, come on, middle way. It's good for your health. No, it's not good for your health. So yeah, it's breaking the precepts, can't get away from it. The law of attraction. Do the thoughts we think really create our world? If they did, you'd be in big trouble. What have you been thinking about? You'd be in big trouble if your thoughts create the world. Because sometimes you think, that person in the next room to me, in the cottage, who keeps making all that noise, I wish she was dead. And if your thoughts create the world, you'd be in big trouble. No, the thoughts are what creates, you know, the perceptions and actions. But you can always say no, you've got this great ability actually to say no, this is just a thought, I'm not going to follow it through with speech and action. It's called restraint. It's the no button. That's a very good one to understand where it is. And even though you feel like sort of shouting at someone and calling them a selfish pig, no, don't do it. It just gets you in more trouble. Otherwise, it will be the law of attraction. You'll attract their fist. Or something worse. Or are we just powerless, being destined by the law of karma? You make the law of karma. Every moment, you're making the karma for your future. Now is the place your future is being made. So if you pay attention to this present moment and get very skilled in this present moment, you are making your future. Now is the time your future is being made. And every time you worry about your future, you are neglecting it. You're looking in the wrong place. So stay in the present moment, and your future is assured. Money back guarantee. So I've got no money. Doesn't matter. Could you please explain in more detail the extent of the third precept? People always like to talk about sex on a retreat. It's interesting, especially by today you get bored. If a married man, a working man, is having sex with a prostitute, obviously working by herself, are both of them considered to be breaking the third precept and committing adultery? So the man is married, the prostitute is single. Is she? I don't know. I'll do one by myself. Go and ask him first of all. Are both of them considered to be breaking the third precept? Commandment? The man usually is, but the woman isn't. Because, you know, that she hasn't got a partner. But if she's got a partner, then they're both breaking the precept. I remember reading this story. It's a very good story for people to understand. Actually, there's two stories. The first story is, it was in the newspapers all over the world. This guy, he was in Madrid in Spain. He'd been married for 20, 30 years. And, you know, he wasn't having such a good time with his wife. You know, what usually happens after 20, 30 years of marriage. Well, not all marriages, but a lot of times. So he thought, oh, come on, I'll just have a bit of fun. So he looked up into the personal columns or wherever you look up to find out, like, you know, a lady of the night, just to have a bit of a fling. Well, he could have actually got, I think it was on the internet. And so he made the appointment. He never told his wife. He said he was just going out. His wife said she was going out that night to see her friends. So he had a free night, and he went to the hotel room where the arrangement was. He knocked on the door. He was very, very scared, but also excited. The first night he was going to go with a prostitute. And when he opened the door, the other side of the door was his wife. She was working part-time as a prostitute without him knowing. He said, the first time the prostitute which I chose was the woman I was married to. That's what actually happens. Story number two, which I read in the newspapers recently. When men try to commit adultery, when they have an affair with someone, they always think they're not going to get caught. They always do that. They think they can, you know, cheat their wife. And apparently, I was reading the newspapers, the head of the CIA recently got sacked because he had an affair. And the newspapers said, if the head of the CIA, with all of the safe houses, with all of the false passports and disguises, if he gets caught out, then there's no hope for any one of you. So you're going to get caught out. The head of the CIA got caught out, so you're going to get caught out for sure. So don't do it. You're going to get into trouble. And it's breaking the precept. And the reason why it's breaking the precept, look, seriously, there may be some of the girls here whose husband has cheated on them. And sometimes it's in a modern world, it works the other way too. What does it feel like? If you've been there, that is real deep pain. The person you've lived with you can't trust. And that causes huge amount of suffering. That's why it's in the precept there. And don't think it's only just a bit of fun. Yeah, you have a bit of fun, but the pain afterwards is just not worth it. You lose the respect of the kids, your marriage just falls apart, and it's so much suffering. It just is not worth it. If you don't believe me, talk to other people who have been through that. And what if a married man is having sex with a high school girl, still with her parents? It gets more interesting as the question goes down. And how does high school? I think the law usually is if it's underage, like they're under 16. Is it under 16? Depends on the country. What is it in sort of Singapore? Is it 16 or 18? Consensual sex? I don't know, because I'm a monk. But anyway, if a man is having sex with a high school girl, still with her parents, I think it depends what culture you're in. I think in most cultures, if it's, say, in Australia, I don't think there's much problem there. Oh, if a married man, he's creating a problem, obviously, because he's cheating on his marriage. So he breaks the precepts. And, of course, sometimes one of the reasons why underage sex is actually prohibited is because, basically, it's not consensual. Because a person's very young, the other one is much more mature and powerful. So you can't really say that it's a girl's free choice. She can be manipulated by the more mature man. Or what if the man has a second wife? If he has a second wife, he's really dumb. That's called, you know, double suffering. But you know, in Thailand, you know what they call the second wife in Thailand? They call it like wife Noi, like the small wife. And this man, I mean, Ajahn Mahabodh told a story. He said this man would say, Venerable Sir, you always says that we should be satisfied with small things. So I got my wife and my small wife. Mia Noi and Pumak Noi. You know that one, that's Thai. Does different cultures in different countries have anything to do with the breach of the third precept? Apparently yes, because it is culturally sort of significant there. I mean, what is allowable in one culture is not allowable in another culture, especially with the age of consent. But then again, now as long as it's consensual and both partners are free, in other words, that, you know, you're not in a committed relationship, and it really is consensual and you're mature, I mean, that's the most important thing, that you're not coercing somebody into sex. They're mature enough, They're mentally competent enough to know what they're doing, and there's no other complicating relationships that they have another partner. Do we choose the country we would like to be reborn in? And if I became a mum, is there some being up there that will choose me because of the lessons that I may be able to teach them? Thank you. A lot of time it's because they've known you before. And they get attracted to you. It may be your sister. Or sometimes it may be this person you cheated in the past life. And they come as your son in this life to get their own back on you. Those of you who have had kids who have caused you a lot of grief. And some people do have these children, and they just cause you so much suffering. You can divorce your husband. What are you going to do with your son? So I reckon that difficult children are there to get their own back on you for how you treated them before. That sounds like justice to me. And when people say children these days don't respect their parents, you know why? Because all those children, they were your parents. And you never respected them. You put them in old people's home and neglected them. You didn't look after them when they were getting very old. And now they come back to exert their revenge on you. That's why in Buddhism we must always look after the elderly. Because they're tomorrow's children. Investing in the elderly is the investment in the future of our country. Look at it that way. It changes the whole way we deal with the elderly. In many governments, what's the point of putting money into the elderly? You're going to get no return. They're going to die soon. But when you realize those elderly are going to come back as your children, then it's really worthwhile investing a lot of resources in looking after people who are old. And I like to say that because now I am getting old. And the country we'd like to be reborn in. Some people choose the country. Look at me. I got reborn in England. A cold, miserable country. I must have done some terribly, terribly bad karma to get reborn in a country like that. Australia's much better. It's nice and warm. Who else has been reborn in really cold countries? Germany. What did you get born in Norway for? Gee, John Andrew, you must have done something. I better not go there because people say, what's wrong with Norway? Can taking codeine interfere with one's ability to meditate? Depends on how much. If you're just taking a painkiller to get rid of physical pain, no trouble at all. But if it's like, to get high, then maybe there's other ways of getting high. Like on limiters. I have a very small beep, and I want a beep, beep. Does the size count? I would feel more confident. And I won't say what the beep is, but I think I know who wrote that question. No. Did you ever read, Schumacher? Small is beautiful. I already said that in Buddhism, we're supposed to have small things and be content with little. So, maybe you may not be so attractive to the other sex, but you'll be more peaceful in your life. That's what I say anyway. It's amazing what questions we get here. But thank you. Thank you very, very, very much. Dear Venerable Emptiness, I'm getting married next year. And one of my dreams is to get the marriage ceremony led by my favourite monk. Who could that be? Is it possible? How to apply for the procedure? I live in another country. What do you want to live in another country for? Yeah, you can come and get married. Come and get married here. So you can get married even in Jhana Grove. Somebody got married. Because they wanted to get married. They met a Borobudur in Indonesia. And that's actually where they fell in love and got married. I fell in love and sort of got engaged. And they thought, wouldn't it be a wonderful thing to get married in Borobudur? So they looked at all the costs. Because not just themselves. They got to fly me out there. their family, their relations, their friends, the hangers-on. They're so expensive. And I said, look, it's Borodpur in Perth, Jhana Grove. So they came here and got married. Much cheaper. So yeah, of course you can get married here. But be careful, I'll tell all my marriage jokes to you. And they're not much fun. The three rings of marriage, you know the three rings of marriage? The first ring of marriage, engagement ring. The second ring of marriage, wedding ring. The third ring of marriage, suffer ring. Yes, yeah. That's the third ring you get after you've been married for a few years. This is one of the people who live here. And they've been married for 30 years. And I saw them after 30 years of marriage, they still hold hands. Isn't that sweet? And I sort of asked him, he said, that's wonderful. He said, yes, when I was going out with her, we'd always hold hands out of love. After 30 years of marriage, I hold her hand out of self-defense. That's my job. Have you ever heard the saying that love is blind? Love is blind. That means that marriage is an institution for the blind. Okay, I can go on like this. It's good fun being a monk. I can get away with it. If I had a wife, she'd hit me and I would never be able to say these things. You're not romantic enough. Dear Ajahn, on this retreat I have stopped drinking coffee. I have noted an improvement in my vision. I can see small print more easily. This has happened before also when giving up coffee. The other time I was meditating, sitting quiet in Buddhist monasteries in Thailand, very peaceful. This led me to wonder if retreatants may participate in some basic medical tests, pre and past retreat, blood pressures, cholesterol levels, blood content, and I say food smoking. Perhaps this may be merely academic curiosity for someone interested in health. I already know the benefits of meditation and Dhamma. I know that, you know, I like my tea, but remember one retreat, 3 months, I just to show that I wasn't attached to my cup of tea, being born in England, I said, I'm going to not drink tea for 3 months. And the monk came to see me that evening and said, Ajahn Bum, don't do that. Please don't do that. Because he was with an English monk some years ago who did the same thing. Who gave up tea. And my goodness, he was a pain in the neck all the 3 months. Because when he missed his cup of tea, he got really depressed, angry, grumpy. So, if you are grumpy when you stop drinking coffee, out of compassion for the people who have to put up with you, please take your coffee again. Otherwise, you're impossible to live with. People actually tell me that. They don't speak with their husband until he's had his first cup of coffee in the morning. But, if it increases your eyesight, I mean, what are you going to see anyway? I've been there, seen that, so who cares? Why did it take Anuruddha such a long time to reach Sotapanna? Will you be mentioning different stages of enlightenment in your talks? Who knows? The future is uncertain. I don't know what I'm going to say tomorrow. Maybe I will. Maybe I won't. That's what makes life exciting. So it's great that he took such a long time, because it gives confidence to you. But because you haven't been... That was 17 years. How long have you been on this retreat? Is it 6 days or 7 days? 17 years retreat. So never mind. Some people are fast, some people are slow. Ajahn Brahm, just now I was aware of myself craving for certain foods since yesterday night. Shall I keep on the precept of not eating afternoon, or shall I go for the food? The craving of food. Oh, I can close your eyes now and imagine it. Can you smell it? Can you see it? Can you see the steam coming off it? Can you actually smell it and it's just like it's right in front of you? Oh, yes. That's called self-torture. What do you do that for? The craving of food made me gastric and upset my stomach. My stomach kept talking to me, I'm hungry for food. Please advise, thank you. You just tell your stomach, shut up. Shut up. If you think about it, then actually all those gastric juices do actually start coming out. But if you don't think about it, the stomach calms down. There was this monk, he was an Australian monk, and he had some sort of tummy problems, and so this was in Thailand, they decided to give him what's called a barium meal, to actually to see what was going on in his tummy. So the barium meal is this, you know, this gunk which you have to drink, and it's slightly radioactive. So they can put you on this x-ray and actually find out where it goes through your stomach, see if there's any blockages, see if everything goes through okay. And so the stupid people in Thailand, they gave him the barium meal test in the afternoon, about 2 or 3 o'clock. And he'd been a monk for several years. So they put the barium meal inside of him, laid him down, and nothing happened. Because he hadn't eaten in the afternoon. His stomach was used in the afternoon and evening to resting. It was so conditioned to that, the barium meal sat there and did nothing. And they always said, you know, this was, you know, they made a mistake, they should have known. You know, after a few conditionings of a few years, your stomach is used to just eating in the morning time, and you're very healthy. So what they actually did, there was a very wise nurse there, said, think of your favourite food. And so he thought of his favourite food, and as soon as he thought about it, the barium meal started to move and started to go through the system. That's all he needed to do. It reminded me that when you think about your favourite food, then you get saliva, you know, you get bile and all this other stuff started getting secreted. So look, if you want to have gastric problems, think of your favourite food when you can't get it. So all these digestive juices come out, but there's nothing to digest. So the idea is, don't think about the favourite food. Think about nimittas. Think about jhanas. Think about non-self. Or even better, don't think at all. Then you're nice and peaceful. Is it normal to still be talking with oneself during a nimitta? Instructions such as just relax, calm, calm, let go, Buddha, Buddha. You sort of can, but it has to be so soft and maybe only once, that's all. Too many instructions and the nimitta will disappear. I call it just like a slight nudge, that's all, but not loud instructions. Then, yeah, okay, it can work. Sorry, Ajahn, today we talk outside meditation room, that we do very bad, or not for everyone in meditation room. It's that bad, we say sorry. Somebody was talking outside the meditation room, and while you were talking, someone else was almost into jhanas, and they were just almost going into the nimitta, and you talked. Oh, that's bad karma. That's really bad karma. Someone was about to get enlightened, and because you talked, you stopped. Imagine if you were just outside the Bodhi tree when the Buddha was about to become enlightened, and you started talking, there'd be no Buddha, no Buddhism. That's real bad karma. So, go somewhere far, and you can talk as much as you like, but not in here. Dear Ajahn, what would you write on a headstone? If it was one word, what would it be? It would be, shut up. It would be good. Two words, no, you put it together, hyphen. What else could you say? Gone to reincarnate? No. See you next life? No. I don't know. Because actually, I wouldn't write anything on my headstone, because I'd be dead at the time. How can I write something on my own headstone? I'd probably write on, shh, keep quiet, meditating. Or, what else could I say? If I could write many words, I'd say, I was probably in jhana and you buried me, stupid. Or something like that. Anyway, it is time what you were talking about. Oh, is it? It is true what you were talking about the other night. Of course it's true. Do you think I would say false things to you? Do you think I don't know what I'm talking about? Actually, a lot of time I don't know what I'm talking about, but it's amazing. If you're confident, It's amazing what you can get away with. It's true, because one of my favourite experiences was doing a 2-hour talkback show on adult themes, on sex basically, and I was a monk. I didn't know what I was doing. I came to this radio show here in Perth, and say it was 6PR, I think. Someone invited me to kind of do a talkback show. So after the Friday night talk, I went to the radio station in East Perth, went in, because I was a bit late, so I didn't have any time to find out what I was supposed to be talking about. Went into the studio, put the headphones on, right in front of the microphone as the host opened the program. So this evening, we are very lucky to have Ajahn Brahm, Buddhist monk, and also Dr. Gabriel Morrissey, the expert on sexual matters and adult themes. And I thought, oh my God, what have I got into? And then I found out, I couldn't get out, I was right in front of the studio and it was a red light was on. And there was a show on adult themes when people, the members of the public, would ring up, you know, on all the things about whether you got a small you know what. And I had to give up. That was really good fun. I enjoyed that. And, you know, this was like, I always remember her name, Dr. Gabriel Morrissey. I mean, she's this professor of, you know, sexual stuff in Australia. And she's got many books, apparently. And she is the expert in this country. And all these people were ringing up, and they had a choice who they would call, and they kept on asking for the monk. And, you know, she was actually sitting there really bored while I did all the work. It showed, actually, I know more about the subject than she does. I don't know anything, but I made it up as I went along, and it went very good. And the other thing was, I went to this conference in the Datsun Hotel in Perth, and it was on transport issues, because we had problems with trucks past our monastery some time ago. And so because I was fighting that, I got well known as a traffic advocate for peace and quiet. So they had this government had a conference about trucking on the roads in Western Australia. And for those of you who know Alana McTeen, who I got to know, she invited me up there as a member of the public. And so when it got to lunchtime, they all had their lunch. It was after 12, so I couldn't have anything to eat. So I was just hanging around, and this reporter came up to me. And he said, I work for the shipping magazine. I want to do an interview with you about the Buddhist attitude to shipping. This is true. I'm not making this one up. And I'm willing to do anything, you know, just for a joke, to see what would happen. So, you know, he asked me all these deep questions, and I gave these answers, you know, which I was just making it up. And I saw him about 4 or 5 months later, and he said, he came up to me and said, do you remember me? I said, of course not. And I meet so many people. He said, I was that guy who interviewed you about shipping. And I publicized that article. He called it, you know, very quiche, Zen and the Art of Shipping by Ajahn Brahm. And that, he said, that was syndicated in every major shipping journal in the world, translated into other languages sometimes. And he got all these emails back from all these professors and experts in shipping, all saying, we don't know who this guy Ajahn Brahm is, but he certainly knows what he's talking about. That's really funny. It just shows you so-called experts. If I can get away with it and sort of say I know what I'm talking about, imagine what other people could do. So don't believe the professors. They're making it up, just like I did. Anyway, it's true what you're talking about the other night. This is what I was starting off with. How animals get off on being around your peaceful meditative energy. My cat comes and lays beside me almost every time I meditate. And my dog will come and lick my toes and my knees. But I will draw the line at reptiles coming to get off on my energy. Oh, why? Just this little snake. It just loves you. It's just coming along to sort of say hello and get nice and peaceful. Poor snakes. No one likes snakes. But you know what snakes really like? To be scratched just under here. You want to try it? It's so rare, that's why the reptiles like it. No, the reptiles are okay. They won't hurt you. So I get off of reptiles. Just before coming on this retreat, I was meditating in the living room, just starting to get peaceful, when a huge black lizard was in front of me. Excuse the language, but it scared the S-H-I-T. I said that word before, so I can say it again. Scared the shit out of me. Then I end up screaming and crying. Ah, what do you do that for? Just a nice little black lizard wanted to sort of come and get off on your energy. Lizards are okay, they don't harm you. It was probably a meditator in a previous retreat who slept too much. Dear Ajahn, if there's so much suffering in the world, why do we bring children to this world? Is that the punishment for having sex? The children didn't have sex, you had the sex. That's your punishment. No, don't look like that. There's no such thing as punishment in Buddhism. So that's actually a good question. Is it good to have more children in this world? Because, you know, it's an uncertain world. You know, don't know about climate change or wars or water problems and all these other difficulties facing our civilization. And it's also, you know, you bring your child into a very uncertain place. But then, I remember asking that question, and one person gave this wonderful answer. No, you're giving a person a chance to have a human life, which is supposed to be one of the best lives where you can learn the Dhamma and make progress on the path to enlightenment. And I put it that way, I thought, that's actually quite a good idea. Because then you actually bring up a human being who can have a good chance to become enlightened. And especially if you're a Buddhist. And my argument, if you're a Buddhist, to have children is because many of you are getting old. When you get too old, I need someone to bring food to me and feed me. So that's why you should have lots of children, to feed the monks when you guys are old. Totally self-serving. I'm only joking, but I don't believe that. But no, it's up to you, whatever you want. But actually, it's much better to have a dog. A dog or a cat, I mean, they don't cause you any trouble. They're always pleased, and they never talk back at you. Dog never talks back at you, even if you shout at the dog. It just wags its tail and licks you. Really weird. It would be great to have a husband like that, wouldn't it? Anyway. Please read this a little more slowly. I'm not sure how to put this. However, is that too slow? Sorry, I'm being playful. Can we make a correlation between science and religion? Isn't all physical manifestations, including inanimate objects, energy vibrating at different rates, and in human form are more space than matter? Could we say this? No thing you speak of is light, and what we incarnated, we purposely forgot this in order to rediscover our true nature as spirit. A cosmic game, and we take ourselves so seriously. That's my trouble. I take myself far too seriously. No, it's... You might call of it as light, in the sense of being light-hearted. Don't be heavy. The stronger your sense of ego, the more solid it is, the more heavy you are. And as you start disappearing, in the art of disappearing, things start to vanish. You get lighter and lighter and lighter. And we know that you're light-hearted. When you laugh very easily, serious people never laugh, and they die very young. That is very true. You may have noticed that I'm only very, very slightly overweight. Actually, I'm not overweight. I suffer from anorexia. It's true. I suffer from anorexia because I looked in a dictionary once. The definition of anorexia is... You look in the mirror and you think you're fat. And that's me. Every time I look in the mirror, I think I'm fat. So that's the definition of anorexia. So that's why I want to eat more. Someone gave me this article. I've got it somewhere in my room. It's been well proven through science. This is where science and religion meet. Well proven through science, if you laugh, especially if you laugh a lot and you're very happy, your blood vessels get bigger and bigger and bigger. They dilate. But when you get miserable, angry, upset, fault-finding, your arteries contract and get smaller and smaller. Which is one of the reasons I can be overweight with no problem at all. Because I laugh so much that my arteries and my veins, all my blood vessels, are so expanded. All that gut can go through. It's like a superhighway. It never gets clogged. Never any traffic jams. So you never get... But if you are fat and miserable, then you're in big trouble. You've got the double whammy, extra cholesterol and narrow arteries, you die. And that explains why it is in most cultures all fat people are happy, jovial. Now Santa Claus, ho 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 ho. And he's been there for 2,000 years. He laughs a lot, that's why he can be overweight without any problem at all. So if any of you are putting on weight, you better start laughing quick, otherwise you're going to die. And for those of you, you know, who like your food, but you're watching your weight, look, laugh a lot, and you can eat whatever you want. So that's my Buddhism science. Meditation sitting. When you write in your book about establishing these preliminary stages properly, it is suggested to do so each time sitting down. Will there come a time when one can go directly to the breath? Yeah, of course, you just sit down, let go and see what happens. So just at the beginning you have to train yourself. You know what it's like sometimes when you drive a car. When you go, the driving instructor says, now you sit down, you make sure you're in neutral, then you turn on this sort of the engine, then you sort of, actually a long time since I've driven the car. Then you take off the brake, you put it in first gear, rah rah rah. Now look around. You have all these instructions you learn when you're, first of all driving a car. But once you learn how to drive a car, you forget all of those. It becomes natural, automatic. Don't even need to think about it. So that's with meditation. At first, yeah, you've got to train yourself, but after a while it's automatic. Dear Ajahn, is there one thing that absolutely breaks my... If there... is one thing that absolutely breaks my heart is all the suffering and cruelty that some humans inflict on the poor animals. I feel so helpless. What can I do practically for animals everywhere to feel my genuine love for them? It's obviously the care for the animals as best you possibly can. And one of the things is actually to realize that the animals are not that much different than human beings. And human beings are not that much different than animals. Some more than others. And when you actually start to see the empathy between the animals and the humans, it's much easier to have kindness towards them. But if you think a fish can't feel, you can put this hook in the river and hook these poor little animals and pull the hook out and think, animals can't feel, it doesn't matter. But it does. Animals do feel. Only recently I remember seeing, about 3 or 4 years ago, they finally proved by doing this CT scans on fish's brains that yes, when they get their hook in their mouth, they feel it. It's pain. It hurts. But because of that, that some Buddhists, they still feel they like going fishing. And they come up to me, is it okay? Because I just throw the fish back in again. I don't kill them. I just torture them. And I said, that's very bad still. So I said, look, but I said... And they said, no, I go fishing. I don't go there to catch the fish. It's just for the peace and the calm. It calms me down on a Saturday or Sunday. And I said, okay, if the reason you're going fishing is for peace and calm, I give you permission to go. Go fishing, especially if you're a Buddhist. But a Buddhist fisherman, they never put a hook on the end of the line. They throw it in. And no one knows, except the fish. You've got no hook on the end of the line. And all your friends think, oh, you just got bad luck. But you know you haven't got a hook on the end of the line. And for you, it's even more peaceful when you're not disturbed by this thing tugging on your line. So if you like going fishing as a Buddhist, please go. But make sure you don't put a hook on the end of the line. If there is one that breaks my heart, there's also some of the other stuff which happens with animals. such as the testing drugs on animals. That's really gross. You don't need to do that these days. So if you want to sort of, you know, join these groups so that, you know, you find out what, say, cosmetics for girls, you know, they test on animals. Don't buy that. Buy other stuff which is not tested on animals. Ajahn, I've been self-harming. I've been self-harming since I was 12. It started with digging a comb into my hand. Now I use a knife. I hate everything and there is no hope. Exactly. I think that's a joke question. Is it? Sometimes I don't know if these questions are serious. So, what? If that really is a serious question, I don't think it's a serious question, because people who are self-harming would never be actually coming on this retreat. So, if you have got like this self-harming, a lot of the time it is because ever since you were 12, people always putting you down, criticizing you, telling you you're not good enough, you're not pretty enough, you're not smart enough, you're not everything enough. And because you take that criticism on board and you believe that you're not good enough, that is why people have this terrible sense of self-harm. Just basically punishing themselves. Real Buddhism, we don't have punishment. If you make a mistake, you acknowledge it, you forgive it, which means no punishment, it means amnesty, and you learn from it. It's all right to make mistakes. From mistakes, we learn and we grow. Punishing, it just stops our growth. So number one, please, no punishing. Even here, many of you deserve to be punished. How much you've talked and made noises and not come to the morning meditations. But I'm not going to put you in detention after the retreat. I'm not going to give you right out 100 times. I will not talk in the cottage. Whatever it is. I will not snore in the morning meditation right out 200 times. You don't do that here. So, but when you have that sort of sense of lack of self-esteem, then of course you do get into self-harming. And the way to overcome that is to praise yourself and other people praise you. And if other people won't praise you, you praise yourself. You look in the mirror and you say, I am a beautiful person. Even if it means breaking your fourth precept. Take your hands and stroke your hair. Yes, I love me. Or, I think I did this already here the first day. You put your arms out. Did I do this the first morning? No, okay, put your arms out. Right out. Bring them in. Give yourself a nice hug. If no one else can love you, at least you can love yourself. And that is starting to stop the self-harm. Eventually, you can understand that opening the door of your heart. One day you say to yourself, me, this person I've been trying to harm, the person I thought I don't like, me, the door of my heart's open to myself. With all the stupid things I've done, all the sort of the stuff in my past, whatever's going to happen in the future, the door of my heart is fully open to me, no matter who I am, no matter where I go, no matter what I do. Open the door of your heart, and then you don't go self-harming. Dear Jambam, you say we have no free will. If that's the case, how can we have choices in our thoughts, speech and actions, or do we not have any choices? You think it's your choices, but it's not. I have gone into your brains. I am conditioning you. I made you ask that question, and you didn't know anything about it. That's freaky and scary. That's exactly how advertising works. We all think that advertising affects other people, but it doesn't influence us. You go through those airports and you see all of those adverts. You see it on TV and on the road and you think, yeah, that's just an advert. It doesn't affect me. That's the great trick of advertising. It gets in your brain without arousing your suspicions. And I usually tell my story about advertising. One of those events which made me start to wonder, you know, have I got free choice or not? When I was at university, I saw an advertisement on the TV for St. Bruno tobacco. I still remember it to these days. That was the days before we really knew that cigarettes were actually bad for your health. I never smoked cigarettes, but I tried this. So it was really cool to have a pipe, you know, these little wooden pipes, and put a bit of, you know, because this was university, it showed you, you know, you were an academic and you could think, you know, when you put this stuff in there. It was that's what it used to be in those days. So, but this particular tobacco, on the advertisement, had an ordinary looking guy. Now, he wasn't one of these, you know, really sort of hot, you know, drop-dead gorgeous guys. Just an ordinary looking guy, not some sort of male model. And he was walking down the street of some sort of town in England, because that's where I was. And he got out his pipe and put some Bruno tobacco in and lit it. And then the aroma, he just happened to be passing a newsagent. And behind the newsagent was this incredibly gorgeous girl. Now, I've been in many newsagents. You don't have gorgeous girls in newsagents, except in the advertisements. And this gorgeous blonde, you know, drop-dead gorgeous, she took one whiff of this St. Bruno tobacco, jumped over the counter, and followed this guy, waiting to do his every command. Then he went past, you know, the vegetable shop with the fruits and vegetables. And another beautiful redhead, you know, should be like in the front cover of some glossy magazine. She also smelt the aroma of St. Bruno tobacco. And she too was entranced and followed behind the blonde. And after about four or five shops, only about a minute on the advertisement, this ordinary looking guy was being followed by like a whole harem of the most beautiful women you could ever imagine. Because St. Bruno tobacco is irresistible to women. And that's where it stopped. Now, isn't that a stupid advertisement? Who would believe that? I did. I bought some tobacco. I put it in a pipe, walked out of shop. I think a dog followed me about. And no gorgeous women followed me at all. But from those experiences, you realize just how much, you know, you buy into these things. You don't think you are. But that's when you go into the supermarket, when you go to the shopping mall, you buy this stuff. Why? You really think it's your free choice. If it really was your free choice, there'd be no money to be made in advertising at all. But the truth is, for every dollar, this is general, every dollar spent in advertising, you get $3 returned. That's how powerful it is. So all those silly advertisements you see on TV, you think they're just so childish, they work. They're childish because you think, you're above that, you're not going to accept it. That is a trick. That you assume they're not really listening, but you do it. It gets into your head and you buy that product the next time you go to the supermarket. That just really tells you just how much free will is not there. I am brainwashing you again. My mother-in-law. Now the mother-in-law story. My mother-in-law goes to these temples, most of them, and I think are Mahayana. And I find that they encourage lots and lots and lots of chanting instead of meditation. Why is that? Because mothers-in-laws have got strong mouths. And they go to do chanting to train them. So they can come and nag you even more, because they do chant for hours some of these in some of these temples. So that's like, you know, exercise for their talking. So that's why when they come home, you're in really big trouble. But if you send them to meditation, they become quiet and peaceful. Isn't that a much better mother-in-law who's silent? So don't send your mother-in-law to Mahayana temples. She'd get worse and worse with all that training for her mouth. Send to the Theravada temples where you can meditate. Shut up. If one chants many, many times, it is like a meditation itself. Even before she went for a pilgrimage, she was encouraged to chant tens of thousands of verses, which was apparently very good. Is it to purify the heart? I'm confused. Please advise, thanking you always. Oh, come on, because sometimes too much chanting. Just, I'm chanting now. I'm chanting my yawn chant. Sometimes that we think that lots and lots of chanting is very, very good for us, but look, you can get these machines these days which do the chanting for you. You know, you press them and I see them go round and round and round and it keeps on going, whether it's Amitofo or Ammanipadmi Hum or Namo Buddhaya, again and again and again, forever. That's much better than doing the chanting yourself. You just get a battery, plug it in, and then off you're chanting for a long, long time. But if you do the chanting yourself, at least it does focus the mind. So you're not thinking about all sorts of stupid things. But it also does tire you as well. It takes a lot of energy. So if you want to do some chanting, it's much better to keep it just short. Not too much, not too little. Chanting for many hours, I think, is just over the top. But that's my idea. As you suggested, I put some loving kindness into walking meditation today, and the mind was silent in the present moment. Before I did this, the mind wouldn't stop thinking. All I did was say to myself a few times, may I be well and happy. Of course, it works. I told you so. So try doing loving kindness in your walking meditation. May my left foot be happy and well. May my right foot be free of suffering. The door of my heart is open to you. Left foot, right foot. May all your toes always be happy. Whatever else you do. When you give loving kindness, it engages you with what you're doing. So that's why it works. Dear Ajahn, just a suggestion. We should have a compost bin where we can throw all the plant-based items and let them transform back into the earth. All we have to do is dump and wait and water once a week. Thank you. Tea bath, ground coffee, fruit skin, etc. Yeah, that 2 weeks ago we had the same suggestion. Until Dania said, no, you can't just dump it there. You've got to look after it. Because what would happen as soon as you got a compost area, all the animals in the forest, they will all go there and just make a big mess. And if you have a compost area, some of you get so desperate after not eating that you go in there and just mess around and see what you can find as well. Now the compost bins, you know, sometimes we have compost over in monastery because there's many people to look after it. But when it's only just poor Dania to look after it, it's not really enough. Yes? Snakes. So it attracts all these other creatures because, you know, we live in the forest, and other people live in the forest as well, or other beings. So that's why sometimes it's just not really practical to do that. Last question. I just read in the Devaputta Sanyutta that the Buddha discovered jhana, as you stated, mindfulness bliss and beyond. Of course, I told you so. You know what's going to happen? You're going to get into meditation, you get limiters, and you're going to hear this voice. I told you so. Anyway, how is this viewpoint currently being received in Buddhist circles? Oh, yeah, because sometimes people say the Buddha discovered vipassana. It's not there anywhere. That's just spin. That's just advertising. That's just stuff which is not true. But actually says there the Buddha discovered jhanas. And jhanas is now the in thing in Buddhism. All the cool Buddhists do jhanas. All the ones behind the times, they do vipassana. So if you want to be at the leading edge of Buddhist meditation practice, if you want to be the new age Buddhists, you do jhanas. Jhana is cool. Jhana is, I think, Kiren. Kiren? Yes, it's Bahasa. That means really cool, really trendy. So if you want to be fashionable, You don't want to be one of these old stodgy, you know, old timers, but be on the forefront, be the jhana guy, the jhana girl. So anyway, that's how that's written. Oh wow, it's 9:23, it's a long time. Were you falling asleep tonight? No, because it's fun, you put energy into what you're doing, lots of loving kindness, so it's good fun. Good fun, good dharma, and good night.